is chapter 48. We're continuing our series through the book of Genesis. This is message number 49 in the overall series, and the title of this message is Grace Greater Than Sin. We're going to be looking at chapter 48 in this message, and I want to begin by reading verses 1 to 4. And it came to pass after these things that one told Joseph, "Behold, thy father is sick." And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Jacob and said, "Behold, thy son Joseph cometh unto thee." And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed. And Jacob said unto Joseph, "God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and blessed me. And he said unto me, Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make of thee a multitude of people, and will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession." So chapter 47 that we looked at last time tells all about Israel settling in the land of Egypt. They had moved there because of the severity of the famine and that it was to continue for a number of years in the land of Canaan and in the land of Egypt. But not only had the family of Jacob been saved from annihilation due to the famine, but in the land of Egypt they were thriving and they were prospering. Now, much of chapter 47 deals with the remainder of the famine years in Egypt. It goes through that pretty quickly, actually. But Joseph is continued to be portrayed as a wisdom character in Genesis. He's one that God has blessed with skill and with knowledge. He's one that we see continually making complex plans, and those plans succeed. So his plans are well conceived. They are successful. But ultimately, we are shown in Genesis chapter 47 that Joseph, again, is blessed because God was with him. And that worked out in a number of ways, but that was the reason that Joseph was blessed the way that he was. But it also reinforces to us the fulfillment of Joseph's dreams in his younger days. He had the dreams about the sheaves of grain, his brothers bowing down to his, and the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down to him. And so in Egypt, in chapter 47, we see how that all are bowing down to him in subjection to him. And that includes his brothers and his father. And so those things did come to pass just as Joseph had dreamed that they would. But even in the face of a severe threat and a disadvantage like this famine was, God preserved his people and God prospered his people of Israel there in the land of Egypt. And this he did by sending Joseph ahead of them in order to preserve life and to preserve a way for them to be preserved and prosper. So in God's providence, he took them out of the land of Canaan to the land of Egypt, where he had prepared a place for them so that they could prosper and grow in the land of Egypt before he brings them back. Now, the end of chapter 47 brings the approaching death of Jacob into view. And the book of Genesis is certainly nearing its end and setting us up for these last three chapters that we have in this book. And each of these last three chapters is contributing to the resolution of the beginning of Israel's history. So now we come to chapter 48. And chapter 48 is the first of two chapters that are devoted to the final acts of Jacob. And that is the blessing of his sons. So chapter 48 focuses primarily on Joseph and his two sons, and mostly wraps up the story of Joseph. And the chapter also draws attention to the younger Ephraim being blessed greater than the elder Manasseh of the sons of Joseph. And that has been a pattern that we have seen among the patriarchs as we have gone along throughout the book of Genesis. This is something that Paul picks up on, in fact, in Romans chapter number 9, as an illustration of election. In other words, the blessings of God are gifts of grace that are given. They're not debts that are owed. They're not rewards that are earned or deserved. So as we look at this chapter, we want to look at it in two parts, in verses 1 to 13, where Joseph presents his sons to Jacob, and in verses 14 to 22, where Jacob blesses the sons of Joseph. So we're going to start in the first part. Let's read verses 1 to 4 again. And it came to pass after these things that one told Joseph, "Behold, thy father is sick." And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And one told Jacob and said, "Behold, thy son Joseph cometh unto thee." And Israel strengthened himself and sat upon the bed. And Jacob said unto Joseph, "God Almighty appeared unto me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me and said unto me, 'Behold, I will make thee fruitful and multiply thee, and I will make of thee a multitude of people and will give this land to thy seed after thee for an everlasting possession.'" So the opening line here, that it came to pass after that, is indicating that there is a break from the previous account. It marks off, in fact, this closing part of this larger last section of Genesis. The previous chapter ended, as you will recall, with Joseph making promise to Jacob that he would bury Jacob in Canaan, in Machpelah. He would not bury him in the land of Egypt. And that obviously gave an advance notice of Jacob's pending death. But now we see at the opening of this chapter that after a while, there was an announcement that Jacob was sick. And this signals to us that he is near the end of his life. In fact, as we go on reading the account, you see that he's in the bed there. He sets up on the bed. Later references, like in the book of Hebrews, picture him leaning over and seeking support. We're also told here that his eyesight had become very dim. And so Jacob is right at the very end of his life. So Joseph comes to visit Jacob here and brings his two sons with him, the two sons that were born to him in Egypt. And their arrival revived Jacob a little bit. It says, you know, he strengthened himself and he sat up on the bed so that he could set up and speak to them and to do what he needed to do. So Jacob begins in verses 3 and 4 by confirming God's covenant with him through his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. And Jacob here mostly quotes what we read in Genesis chapter 35, verses 11 and 12. But he focuses on three particular promises, three particular covenant promises that God confirmed to Jacob. And the first of those is that he would be fruitful and multiply. Now that is a phrase that we have encountered a number of times in Genesis. And this is the last time that we encounter it in the book. But if we trace the way that this phrase is used throughout Genesis, we're going to see that this has particular significance for Israel, particular covenantal significance. So the phrase is used in two ways. One is as a command to be fruitful and multiply, and another as a statement of what God will do, make fruitful and multiply. So here, let's just walk through the occurrences of this phrase, noting how that they are used. So the first time that it occurs is actually in Genesis 1, which is the account of the creation of the heavens and the earth. And so it was a command that was issued to all the various forms of life that God had created, that they were commanded to fill the earth. That's in chapter 1, verse 22. And then it was a command that was issued to Adam and Eve after the creation that they were to fill the earth, obviously, with humankind, as the animals were to fill the earth with animal kind. That's in chapter 1 and verse 28. So God created the earth to be inhabited, and he commanded life on the earth to be fruitful and multiply, to fill the earth with life, both that animal life and the human life. Now, the next time that this phrase occurs is in Genesis chapters 8 and 9, in fact, after the flood. So it is a command that's once again issued to animal life after the flood in chapter 8 and verse 17 in order to fill the earth because all life was destroyed off the face of the earth. It's also a command that's issued to Noah and his sons, the only living human beings at the time, that they are to fill the earth. That's chapter 9, verses 1 and 7. Now, the next time that this phrase occurs, it occurs to Abraham. In fact, it's a covenant promise in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 2 that God is going to make Abraham fruitful and multiply him. It is a covenant promise in Genesis chapter 17 and verse 20 issued to Ishmael because he is truly Abraham's firstborn son, but he's not the son of promise. He's not the son of choice, but nevertheless, because of his connection with Abraham, he will be blessed and become a great nation as well. And then it is confirmed to Abraham after that he was tested in offering Isaac. That's chapter 22 and verse 17. The next time this phrase occurs, it occurs to Isaac and God confirming the covenant promise. That's in Genesis chapter 26, verse 4 and verse 24. The next time that it occurs is the blessing. It occurs to Jacob. It's a blessing from Isaac to Jacob in Genesis 28, 3. And it is a covenant confirmation by God to Jacob in Genesis chapter 35 and verse number 11. And then we have this current reference where Jacob is referring back to Genesis chapter 35 and verse number 11. That's all the occurrences of this phrase in the book of Genesis. And by the phrase, I mean these two words used together. After the book of Genesis, this phrase does not occur very much. And it is only used in two ways after the book of Genesis. Number one, it is used of Israel growing to become a great nation. That's Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, and Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 9. The only other way that this phrase is ever used in the Old Testament is in prophecies of Israel's future restoration. So that is would be Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 16, Jeremiah chapter 23 and verse 3, and Ezekiel chapter 36 and verse number 11. So in other words, God makes this promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he's going to make them fruitful and multiply into a great nation, particularly with Jacob and the nation of Israel. We see that being fulfilled in as we go forward into the book of Exodus and the rest of the books of Moses as Israel grows and multiplies into a great nation. And then, of course, through the judgments, they are greatly reduced and made desolate. But in their future restoration, it's prophesied that they will once again become fruitful and multiplied. In fact, one of the images of Israel in their ongoing exile is that of a barren widow woman that is destitute of any family and impoverished and vulnerable and oppressed and afflicted. But that's going to be reversed in that restoration. Well, the reason why I looked at that particular phrase and the way that it was used is that we have to understand the significance of that phrase. It was used with Adam. It was used with Noah. And then it was used with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that is all of the uses that we have. So in other words, this be fruitful and multiply is not a general charge to every human being on earth, nor is it a charge that is given to Christians today as though that is the mission's strategy that we are to overtake the earth by bringing forth multitudes and multitudes and multitudes of children. This is a specific command and a promise that pertain to the nation of Israel that God chose and plans to use to bless all the nations of the earth. And so there is great significance in the phrase that Jacob uses. Now, the second aspect of the covenantal promise that Jacob focused on is the promise that there would be a congregation or an assembly of tribes that would come from Jacob. Now, that was the phrase used back in chapter 35 and verse 11 again. That's the first time that it occurred. It occurred in promise to Jacob. And it refers specifically to the nation that God promised to make a new nation and what we come to know as the tribes of Israel. And reference to this promise also provides us the context for understanding the blessings of this chapter and the next chapter. And in the third is the focus on the land that God promised to Abraham. So Jacob, who is, when he speaks these words, who is in the land of Egypt and is soon to die, and he refers to the promise that was first given to Abraham, given also to Isaac, and given to him, that God would give the land of Canaan to them and their seed as an everlasting possession. Now, the phrase everlasting possession does not occur in chapter 35 and verse number 11, but Jacob pulls it from chapter 17 and verse number 8, the promise to Abraham, which shows the continuity of God's covenant promise to come through to Israel through the fathers. So this shows us as Jacob being one that has something to bless his sons and the tribes of Israel with. And then we proceed, verses 5 to 7. And now thy two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which were born unto thee in the land of Egypt, before I came unto thee into Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. And thy issue which thou begettest after them shall be thine, and shall be called after the name of their brethren in their inheritance. And as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died by me in the land of Canaan, in the way. And yet there was but a little way to come unto Ephrath, and I buried her there in the way of Ephrath, the same is Bethlehem. So what we read in these verses is Jacob adopting the sons of Joseph to be as his own sons. Note, he says, they will be mine just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. They are going to be counted as the sons of Jacob. And notice how that Jacob even clarified to Joseph that any further sons that would be born to Joseph or might be born to Joseph after them, they would be Joseph's sons, not Jacob's. But these first two sons of Joseph will be counted as Jacob's sons. Now, this obviously plays out in the next chapter, as well as in the rest of Israel's history. Reuben and Simeon were supplanted by Ephraim and Manasseh, and the tribe of Levi was chosen for priestly service and given no inheritance. And you remember Reuben because of the issue with his father's concubine, and Simeon and Levi because of the issue concerning Dinah and the city of Shechem. They all lost inheritance, Reuben, Levi, and Simeon. And again, this plays out in Israel's history as Ephraim and Manasseh become more dominant tribes, gaining inheritance. And again, the tribe of Levi was not given inheritance. They were rather chosen for priestly service within Israel. So Ephraim and Manasseh, Jacob is saying here, would each grow to a tribe, and the two tribes together would count as the tribe of Joseph. Now, Jacob's reflection on Rachel here is a little bit puzzling, and there's a wide variety of ideas as to why he makes this reference. So on the one hand, it does seem that Jacob has received comfort through Joseph and through Joseph's sons, and he still grieved the death of his most beloved wife, Rachel. But also, the fact that Rachel died upon entering the land of Canaan, and essentially, you might say, died early in life, she would have no more sons. She had Joseph and Benjamin, but she would have no more sons. She was also, maybe a crass way of putting it, but she was the least productive of Jacob's wives, even though he loved her and her children more. So with this adoption, with seeing Joseph again, and Joseph having these sons born to him, and adopting these sons in terms of inheritance, adopting these sons as the sons of Jacob, Rachel would end up with four sons and three tribes having come from her. And in a sense, raising her, you might say, in prominence within the nation of Israel. Let's look at verses 8 to 13. And Israel beheld Joseph's sons and said, "Who are these?" And Joseph said unto his father, "They are my sons, whom God hath given me in this place." And he said, "Bring them, I pray thee, unto me, and I will bless them." Now the eyes of Israel were dim for age, so that he could not see, and he brought them near unto him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said unto Joseph, I had not thought to see thy face, and lo, God hath showed me also thy seed. And Joseph brought them out from between his knees, and he bowed himself with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim in his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh in his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and brought them near unto him. So Moses tells us that Jacob's eyesight was dim and that he could not see. This explains, of course, why he asked who Joseph's sons were. He couldn't see well enough to distinguish them, so he needed to know which was which. Now, most likely, this doesn't mean that he couldn't see at all, or that it doesn't mean that he was totally blind, but he was probably very extremely nearsighted at this point, and his vision very, very poor. So he asks, you know, who these are. He wants to distinguish them so that he knows which son is which. And then we get Joseph, the description of Joseph being very careful that he wants to guide the younger Ephraim to Jacob's left hand and the older Manasseh to Jacob's right hand in order for the blessing that's going to be given or the inheritance that's going to be announced. This was the customary practice, and it was the customary expectation that the firstborn would receive the greater inheritance. So as we get the formality of this process and all this description that we get, it shows us that there wasn't any deception, there wasn't any mistaken identity here, but everything that Jacob does, as well as everything that Joseph does, was very deliberate and with full knowledge. Then we get to the actual blessing of Joseph's sons by Jacob in verses 14 to 22. So let's start with verses 14 to 16. And Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it upon Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand upon Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk, the God which fed me all my life long unto this day, the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, and let my name be named on them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So even though Joseph was very careful that he wants to distinguish between the elder and the younger and to present them properly to Jacob, Jacob actually puts his right hand on the head of the younger Ephraim and his left hand on the head of the older Manasseh. And Moses adds here the explanation that he did it wittingly, or he did it knowingly. He did it with knowledge. In other words, Jacob at this point, he knew which was which, and he did what he did fully intending to bless the elder and the younger as he did. Now the blessing begins here with Jacob identifying with Abraham and Isaac and saying that they walked with God. And that they walked with God was something also said of Enoch back in chapter 5 and verses 22 and 24. It was also said of Noah in chapter 6 and verse number 9. And so we see this as a continuance of the faith and the worship of Yahweh. And he attributes the success of his life to God's blessings on his life. In other words, God has fed me. God has delivered me or redeemed me from all evil. So he attributes all of that to the blessings of God. In other words, the fact that he's here and all of his sons and all of Israel is here in Egypt, and Jacob is in position at the end of his life to give this prophetic blessing. And you have to remember that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were anointed prophets of God. We learned that in Psalm 105, and it's evident again from reading the book of Genesis that that is the case. So he is present and able to give this prophetic blessing upon his sons and ultimately upon the tribes of Israel. And he is acknowledging that all of that is because of the God of his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham. Now he makes reference to the angel here. Some publishers, I don't know how this may be. In fact, my Bible, angel is capitalized. So yours, it may be capitalized. It may not be capitalized. You do have to understand that there is no indication of a capital in the original Hebrew. That is something that translators have determined that to be speaking of the angel of Yahweh and therefore the pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, and that's why it's capitalized. But we can't always just go by capitalizations in an English translation of the Bible. We have to study the context and such. Here, I do believe that it is correct. It is the angel of Yahweh that is being referred to. You notice he says, the God before whom my fathers walked and the angel which redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. In other words, those two together is what Jacob is making reference to. So the angel is a reference to the angel of the Lord or the angel of Yahweh that appears a number of times, these pre-incarnate appearances of Jesus Christ that we've noted before in Genesis. And the word for redeemed that he uses is a word that's also used to speak of the kinsman redeemer in later books of Moses. So Israel on the plains of Moab, reading this account and having this account given to them, would understand the reference as a deliverer or a rescuer through paying the ransom price. So Jacob was redeemed from all evil. He was redeemed from all that would destroy him or would cut him off from the promises of God to his fathers. So he speaks of being redeemed or rescued or delivered from all evil. It doesn't mean that Jacob didn't suffer afflictions. It doesn't mean that he didn't have difficulties. He even stood before Pharaoh and said, "Few and evil have the days of my life been." He experienced a lot of things that we would consider quite negative. But nevertheless, he was redeemed from all of that, but none of it destroyed him. None of it cut him off before he could bring the nation of Israel, as it were, to be. He was preserved in order to inherit the promises that God had made to his fathers. And he also goes on to say of the sons of Joseph, "Let them be named for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So he's here again referring to the fact that he has adopted them as Jacob's sons. Thereby, he is making way, they're making known their right of inheritance. He's not going to give inheritance to any of the other sons of his sons, but he is going to give inheritance to these two sons of his son, Joseph. Now, the word for multitude that is used here is not the word for congregation or assembly. It's a word that refers to a large number. In other words, let their offspring be numerous. And the mention of multiplying, again, puts them in line with Jacob's son in the blessing of Israel. In other words, let all these tribes bring forth abundantly and make a great nation of Israel. Verses 17 to 20. "And when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. And he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said unto his father, 'Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put thy right hand upon his head.' And his father refused and said, 'I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations.' And he blessed him that day, saying, 'In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and as Manasseh.' And he set Ephraim before Manasseh." So Joseph's reaction to the position of Jacob's hands and the blessing that he was giving indicated that he thought his father had made a mistake. In other words, he knew that he was old and he knew that his eyesight was very poor. And even though he had brought them close enough to him to be able to reach out and touch them, he thought he's made a mistake. But notice how that Jacob refuses this correction. And he indicates that he knew what he was doing. He was doing it intentionally. And he's also showing us here, Moses is also showing us here, how that God's covenant order took preeminence, even though Joseph had been exalted to great power in Egypt and technically was over his father Jacob. But nevertheless, Jacob would not bow to Joseph's wishes here, but rather did things, again, being the anointed prophet that he was, did things deliberately the way that he did them. He says that Ephraim would become the fullness of nations. Ephraim would emerge as the premier tribe, particularly in the northern kingdom after the split in Rehoboam's reign. So when you read some of the latter prophets in the Old Testament, you will sometimes have that northern kingdom of Israel simply referred to as Ephraim. And so that tribe emerged as the premier tribe of that northern kingdom. And Jacob blessed them just as he intended to do. And then we've got the end of the chapter, verses 21 and 22. And Israel said unto Joseph, Behold, I die, but God shall be with you and bring you again unto the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to thee one portion above thy brethren, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite, with my sword and with my bow. So now Jacob also blesses Joseph. He prophesied God bringing Israel back to the land that he had promised them. This being a fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham back in chapter 15, verses 13 to 18. And Jacob gave Joseph an additional inheritance in Shechem. And in fact, this refers back to Genesis chapters 33 and 34, where Jacob bought a parcel of ground there. And then later, Simeon and Levi took the city with swords after the incident with Dinah. Now, John actually refers to this in the Gospel of John and the fact that this was the land that was given to Joseph by Jacob. So John chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Then cometh he to the city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, thus sat upon the well, and it was about the sixth hour. So this is, again, reference to the land of Shechem, which came to be near to Samaria, a part of the inheritance of Ephraim. This was the land that was given to Joseph. This is also where Joseph's bones were buried when Israel entered the land with Joshua. So Joshua chapter 24 and verse 32, and the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem, in a parcel of ground which Jacob bought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and it became the inheritance of the children of Joseph. So as we look at this chapter, a chapter like chapter 48, this chapter certainly includes important history for Israel to understand the forming of the nation and to understand the division of the tribes and the inheritances in the land promised to Abraham. But beyond just the importance of the history that is preserved, there are two important spiritual lessons that come through in a chapter like this as well. And the first of those would be living in faith. So this chapter might seem to be just a mere collection of family miscellany or something, but the writer of Hebrews actually singles out this chapter, this instance, as the exhibition of Jacob's faith. So in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 21, he wrote, By faith Jacob, when he was a-dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped leaning upon the top of his staff. So the writer of Hebrews singles out this instance in Jacob's life. And we have a good bit of events in Jacob's life that are given to us in the book of Genesis. But the writer of Hebrews keys on this particular chapter, this particular event, where Jacob is demonstrating his faith. Well, why was that? Well, because this was faith on the part of Jacob because he believed God and he believed his promises. And you notice how this chapter begins and ends with references to those promises that were made and prophecy concerning God's future fulfilling of these promises. He believed what God had spoken to him. He believed what God had spoken to his fathers. And even though they were in Egypt when these events took place. And they were in Egypt and flourishing and prospering at the time. We've already noted how the previous chapter showed us that even though there was a famine and all of the Egyptians are selling off all their livestock, they're selling off all their land, they're selling themselves into servitude, even though all the Egyptians are doing that, the people of Israel are flourishing and prospering, even in the midst of that famine. So they were in Egypt and they were flourishing and growing into that great nation. But Jacob never saw that as their home. He knew they would not stay there. Even though he wouldn't live to see it in his lifetime, he knew that eventually they would come back to that land that had been promised beginning with his grandfather Abraham. So certainly as those Israelites on the plains of Moab that are about to go into this land of promise, we certainly see a reproof here. Think about that generation that had come out of Israel that were longing for Egypt, longing to go back there. Many times complaining and saying things like, were there not enough graves in Egypt that you brought us out into this wilderness to bury us here? Longing to return. And that would be a temptation that that generation would face as well. But even though Jacob was in Egypt, prospering, doing well, flourishing, succeeding, all of his family prospering and succeeding, he never saw that as his home and never longed to stay there. Now, we Gentile believers today are not promised an inheritance in the land of Canaan. That's not for us. But we are promised eternal life in God's kingdom on this earth that he makes new. We are promised forgiveness of sins and glorification through resurrection. And our hopes are in the promises of God and not in what we can achieve in this present world. Many of us here may very well be struggling in our present life, in our present situation and circumstance. Many of us may be doing very well. But regardless of whether we are suffering in afflictions or whether we are prospering and flourishing, this present situation is not our future. And it's not where our hope is to be found. The hope for the Christian, it's a future hope for the life that is to come. Jacob didn't receive the promises in his lifetime, but he lived his life in light of them. And that's why he's blessing the sons of Joseph the way he did. That's why he's adopting the sons of Joseph the way he did. Why he's referring to God's covenant with Abraham and Isaac and himself the way that he did. We must also believe God's word and live our lives by it, regardless of what the world looks like or what the world thinks of it or offers us. Now, the second spiritual lesson that we see, particularly in this chapter, is again the grace of God's blessings. Now, Paul picked up on the lives of the patriarchs as an illustration of God's election. This idea of the younger being blessed greater than the elder. This is a thing that was just against custom and against tradition and even against some various things that we see happening in the Bible. The cultures throughout history, this would be something unheard of. But Paul picks up on this and he says that this is an illustration of God's election. In other words, blessings, they come by God's grace according to his own purpose. And what that means is that blessings don't come to us simply because of a natural order. Blessings don't come to us because of our place of birth or our family of birth or the situation of our birth. Blessings don't come to us because of our standing in our families or in our communities or in the world. Blessings are not achieved through human effort or ingenuity. We love that rags to riches story, how someone overcomes oppression and affliction and poverty and raises themselves up to be successful in this life. We love to read about that kind of story. But that's not the way that God's blessings are had. They are a gift of God's grace. And we receive them only through faith. Only through faith. So this is a word of promise to everyone today that through God's grace, you can have a future hope. Through faith in Jesus Christ, you can have an inheritance in eternal life to come, to see his kingdom where he will dwell with his people forever. And just as Jacob recognized God's redemption in his life, our lives can be redeemed from destruction. they can be delivered to the glory of future restoration.